And I said, I want to start a company. And so I was thinking to myself, okay, I got to find the craziest adult that I know that will actually listen to us and take us seriously and help us.
Hey, everybody, and welcome back to Builders, a podcast from BetaWorks Studios. I'm Layla Ueda, and I'll be your guide. That was Beau Peabody, founder of Tripod.com. This week, something different. Yes, it's a beta. Over the years, we've welcomed so many interesting and accomplished builders and entrepreneurs, just like Beau, into our community that we wanted to get a real record of that. So we're starting a regular AMA Ask Me Anything series. As always, the sessions will be hosted live at studios, and we record them so you guys around the world can enjoy them too. If you're new to this podcast or the IDEO Studios, it's our club for builders located here in New York City. It's a place for builders and anyone connected to the startup ecosystem to convene, collaborate, share ideas, secrets, and get building. We host a ton of great events, so be sure to check us out at betaworks-studios.com. The live AMA series is just one of the unique experiences you can find only here at BetaWorks Studios. All right, let's get into it. Kicking us off is Beau Peabody. Beau started one of the first ever social media networks, Tripod.com, while he was still in school back in 1991. He sold Tripod to Lycos in 1998 for $58 million. That was when $58 million was a lot of money. I mean, $58 million is still a lot of money now, but you know what I mean. In this session, Beau will talk about how he got started with Tripod, the funny stories around his name, what starting a company in Williamstown rather than New York or Silicon Valley was like, and how they grew. Beau will also talk about the current startup and investment climate, through his work at Greycroft, and why he thinks New York doesn't think big enough when it comes to launching companies. This is a fascinating episode full of great stories and tips. Beau was interviewed at the start by Vanessa Gregoriadis of the New York Times before they turned over the floor to the community. Again, this is from our live AMA Ask Me Anything series, so get ready for anything.
So you started this in 1991 as a college freshman, and you just basically had an idea like, I should do something about the internet. Can you just set the scene how that happened?
So it was 1992, just to be exact.
Fair.
When we incorporated. My observation was I got to college, to Williams College, and I walked into my dorm room, and we had a suite. There were two dorms that then shared a common room. And I noticed that there was no TVs anywhere. And this is pretty early, 1992, but every single person had a computer. And everybody was doing lots of things on that computer, but none of them seemed like all that fun.
Right.
They were using it primarily for work.
Right.
And they were incredibly useful for
that. Were they doing email?
And still are. Back then, just starting to do email. I had one class that was like constantly on email, but that was like my first sort of introduction to email. And it just occurred to me that we could put some fun things on there too. And that's where the original sort of the seed of the idea came from. And then it had a winding path and morphed to be a lot of different things before it came what everybody knows.
Were they playing video games? What exactly were they doing that was fun?
Some video games that were really sort of rudimentary.
Mm-hmm.
And then some people were going on AOL and CompuServe and Prodigy.
And you were too.
People here might remember.
Yeah.
I did go on AOL, yeah, and so then, and when you looked at those services, it was like, wow, these are really bad.
Mm-hmm.
And we could build something that would be for this younger demographic because those services were geared at an older audience.
So how did you even start talking to your economics professor about this? Like, what was the opening?
Well, I said to myself, all right, I want to start this. I did it with a friend, a guy named Brett Hershey. And I said, I want to start a company. And so I was thinking to myself, okay, I got to find the craziest adult that I know that will actually listen to us and take us seriously and help us. And so we sat down, Brett and I talked, and we said, it's got to be Professor Sabat. He's the guy. He'll listen to us. And we walked into his office, and we said, we've got this idea. And we sort of couched it a little bit in helping students with economic issues, so he would be attracted to it. And we were selling even back then. Mm-hmm. And he agreed to be our third co-founder. Mm-hmm.
So were you just a natural salesperson? Like, in your book, you talk about how Williams didn't let you in for college, and you just kept calling and were like, hey, I just don't take no for an answer. So, were you like a kid with a lemonade stand?
Yep.
Like, what was the...
I was that kid, absolutely. Lemonade stand, lawn mowing. Mm-hmm. Listen, guys, seal coating driveways, I worked in a bike shop, I mm-hmm. had a job, like, always going, and sometimes it was a job, and other times, mostly, it was my own thing. Mm-hmm. So, yes, I was that kid, and it never even occurred to me that I would go to college and then apply for a job.
What did you want to be?
I honestly never say this in the book, that I don't think... The worst thing you can do is wake up one day and say, I'm going to be an entrepreneur. Mm-hmm. Like, I think it comes out of you, you know?
Right.
I mean, I don't want to be dramatic, but it is a little bit like art. Like, it comes out of you, and it either does or it doesn't. And so it never even occurred to me that I would do anything else. Mm-hmm. In fact, it didn't even occur to me to not occur to me. Like, I just did it.
Right.
You know,
and so were you write about, like, entrepreneurs are B students. Like, were you that kind of B student?
So that chapter, that's been, of all the book is, that's a controversial chapter. And I'm not sure I completely still agree with it. So there's a chapter in the book called Entrepreneurs Are B Students, Managers Are A Students. And the notion is that entrepreneurs have to be sort of good at a lot of things and then hire managers who can be really good at each of the disciplines that it takes to run a company. And I believe it, but I've come to believe that it also helps to be an A student. Always.
So how did you come up with the name Tripod?
Oh, it's the worst name ever.
There must have been some logic behind it. That
you know what? It's so bad. It was... There were three of us, mm-hmm. and so...
Oh, my God!
And... I know, it's terrible. And the notion of it as something sort of strong that you can't, like, knock over easily. We debated changing it so many times.
What would you change it to?
That was the question. What would we change it to? And by the time it took off... We were, you know, you don't think about changing it until it's taken off, mm-hmm. right? Because it's like, whatever, we're just doing what we're doing. But then when it takes off, you're like, holy shit, this is gonna be a real thing. We need to, let's change the name. And then by the time you did that, we had so many users. They're like, if we change the name now,
right,
we can't go back, you know? And that was the thing, it was GeoCities had such a better name. It made me so mad all the
it's
time.
It's true. It is much more, yeah.
Tumblr, the names are so much
right,
better.
Right, right, right. So, did you graduate from college?
Yeah.
I mean, I'm just curious. How did you were running this business, but it was concurrent,
I did.
Right?
In fact, Dick Sabat said, look, I'm not going to do this with you guys unless you promise to graduate. You have to graduate or I'm going to get kicked out of here.
Okay.
back then, where I was at school, it was a no-no to do what we were doing. I had to hide. I would lie to my coaches and my professors about what I was doing because being vocational was not something you were supposed to be doing.
Right.
Now, of course, Williams has entrepreneur clubs and accelerator programs and whatever, but back then it was sort of a...
So what year did it really take off?
1996.
So you're already out 96. Of school, you're still living in Williamsburg. Can you talk about Williamstown? Can you talk about why you made the choice to stay in Williamstown?
Because of Professor Sabat. He had four kids. He was like, I'm not leaving.
Right.
And so,
and what was he doing for you?
You know, he was a source of, mostly when I boil it off, thinking back, he was a source of confidence. Mm-hmm. You know, he was just someone who kept challenging our ideas and supporting us and working through, you know, all the documents that we had to create and the presentations that we had to create. And he was just credibility.
Mm-hmm. Can you talk about how you, because I said, okay, we know what it's called now, we know you were in school when you were doing it and the people you were doing it with, but how did you actually put it together and how would it be different today? I mean, that's a complicated question, but
well, I think there's two things. The capital formation situation back then was like a mess. You know, you couldn't, I mean, today, every night of the week in New York City, you can be in a room with dozens of venture capitalists and get free food and drink. Back then,
we need to go do that.
Back then, you couldn't get a meeting unless you knew, unless you were introduced by someone who they knew, you could not get a meeting. Mm-hmm. It was such a smaller ecosystem.
So how did you sit down with Steve Case?
So that didn't happen for a long time.
Okay.
So the first thing we did was this guy named Peter Wilmot, who was the former CFO of FedEx, was a trustee of Williams. And Dick Sabat called him up and said, I'm a professor at Williams. I'm working with these kids. We've got an interesting idea. And the story of FedEx, if you don't know, came from a paper written at Yale that Phil Smith wrote this paper. He got a C minus on the paper, and that turned into FedEx. And so Dick wisely said to Peter, you know, we've got the same situation here, and you're the guy who's going to believe in us. Mm-hmm. So Peter took the meeting. And I don't know if I tell the story that
and so
happened.
How did you explain what the actual product was to him?
We explained it as we are going to build an online service for young people to compete with AOL, Prodigy, and CompuServe. Back then, the internet didn't, the web didn't exist, so Mosaic had not been written. The internet was a text-based.
But AOL had things on it.
AOL wasn't the internet. I mean, AOL was modem.
Well, tell people what AOL had on it at that point,
I mean, people here remember. AOL was a disk.
I don't know about that.
Some of us do.
A disk. You know, you got a disk, you put it into your computer, and that's what created the graphics.
It was insane, yeah.
And then the interactivity came from dialing in
But you dialed in and there was different chat rooms you could go into and you could talk to people. You couldn't really do much more than chat with people, right? That's basically it, and send your email.
And it would call information and populate it in the pre-populated graphics that were on your hard drive. That was sort of the, it was quite clever actually, right? Given what we had back then, it was very clever. And so that's how we pitched it, was we're going to build a young version of this. Mm-hmm. And what was extraordinary was that in 1994, 95, when Marc Andreessen wrote the first browser, he was in the academic community, we were in the academic community, we saw it really early. And it was this, you talk about capital efficiency of the internet, so we had a $10 million business plan. I still have it. A $10 million business plan that we were shopping around to build modem racks, to build an X25 network, to build modem racks in all these cities, to basically replicate what AOL and CompuServe had built. And in one day, seeing that browser and seeing what it could do, our business plan went from $10 million to $375,000 to launch a website.
So you saw it through the academic community? You really saw it because it was in a journal, or who showed it to you?
This guy, his name is Max something, I shouldn't remember his name, but he said, you know, you've got to see this thing, it's incredible, it's called the World Wide Web, it takes the internet, it makes it graphical, it's this browser, and when I looked at it, I had been studying AOL and CompuServe and Prodigy so much that when I looked at it, and I said, that's better.
Right.
And it's free.
So you'd already had the meeting, the FedEx meeting.
Yeah, that we had already raised money from him.
Oh, okay,
yeah.
Okay.
We gave away 9% of the company for 25 grand. That's how hard it was to form capital at that point.
Right.
And in fact, it was even worse than that. He said, I'll give you 25 grand for 6% and 3% to use my name.
Oh, God. Does anybody have any questions? Sorry, go ahead.
No. And then we took that and raised another 100. So we started off with 125 grand, for which we gave away like some crazy, I don't know, like 25% of the business.
Anybody have any questions about this?
Try not to do that.
That's insane.
So I have a first question. Yeah. So, because this is a question that lots of entrepreneurs face now, and obviously you were in an early days kind of version of this. But, I mean, at that point when you wanted to take money on, what was going through your head in terms of, obviously you mentioned potential downsides, you gave away 9% of the company for $25,000. But, like, what were you really thinking about in terms of, do I do this or don't I do this, and why I should do it or why shouldn't I do it in terms of taking funding on?
Well, here's what I tell people this now, because I joke about the valuation, but I always tell entrepreneurs that you shouldn't be that focused on valuation, right? I mean, if you're a first-time entrepreneur, the most important thing is you need to record a win, right? That's That's the most important thing. Whether you own 10% of it or 90% of it, you got to record a win, right? Because if you record one win, your career gets a lot easier from there. And so if the valuation's this or if it's that, it doesn't really matter. So I wasn't thinking that way then, but I think I was instinctively thinking, like, we're just going to need this money because we need to pay for this market research report and we need to pay for a prototype and we need more. We don't have the money, so we need to raise the money. So it wasn't even really, we just did it. I mean, it was the only path. It was the only path.
Yeah, go ahead.
What do you mean by record a win?
Yeah, you know, I think the thing that kills most businesses is undercapitalization. So if you aren't capitalized properly, your chances of having a success, which is what I mean by record a win, are greatly diminished. You know, it's amazing how often I see that hurt, just kill companies. Not bad ideas, not bad management, just they can't access capital. And that's a lot different today when there's so much of it, but it's still even the number of startups has expanded to fill the amount of capital, and so you still have a supply-demand imbalance, and it just you have to raise the capital, right? Unless you can somehow get to profitability early, you got to do it.
So when did you first start coming to New York and becoming seeing the Silicon Alley scene gel?
So we're up there, 3 hours away from here. We've got this crazy loft space in downtown Williamstown. Mm-hmm. and you know, we're recruiting from New York and from San Francisco and LA and Chicago to get people to come. When we realized we were a media company, we realized we needed to have an office in New York because we were going to sell ads. By the way, when we started, we had no idea what the revenue model was going to be. Banner ads didn't exist. And we had no idea how we were going to make money. We thought we were going to make money by subscriptions because that's how AOL and CopyServe were making money. So we went down that path. And then when the banner ad came out, we said, oh, we're going to go that path. And that was when we decided, okay, we need to be in New York. And the trouble for us was we needed to have a sales office in New York, but we didn't want to move any of the product to New York because we had already gotten to 20 or 25 people in Williamstown, and we didn't want to sort of bifurcate the company. So it was hard because, like, I would come down to New York, I would try to recruit people, and I would say, you know, come on up to Williamstown. And they would go, well, I can just work in this office. And I'm like, unless you can sell
awesome
ads.
Awesome snowshoeing.
Yeah. Unless you can sell ads. And so recruiting people was hard, but, you know, it was the thing that everybody says, right? It would be hard to recruit them, but they would stay. Mm-hmm. So our retention was 99%.
So what did you think of the scene here when you came here? I mean, how did you see it kind of evolve?
So we were sort of a company looking for a scene, right? I mean, we didn't have a scene up there. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we gravitated to New York. And I was just amazed by, you know, back then, and again, I don't want to make it sound dramatic and like we were, you know, but it was a little punk rock, you know? Like, it wasn't the way it is. It was, people were just doing stuff, and it was media driven, and there was great sites like Word that I'm sure some people remember, and suck.com, and just all these crazy, really sort of fringy projects,
awesome.
You know,
right.
And it wasn't so much at that point about, you know, build a, you know, MVP and get product market fit, and it hadn't been business school -ified, you know, and which I think it has to, and it's good that it is, and I'm a part of that, so I'm a supporter of it. But it was great when it was just people mucking around.
Like, right,
there was
right.
no playbook.
Right.
Zero playbook. In New York, what a perfect place for that type of a culture, because New York just thrives on those types of things. So it was just, there were people, you know, just trying everything under the sun, and the scene was great, and it was small, and everybody really knew each other, and there was probably four venture capital firms.
So when do you think that started to change? Like, was it, I mean, before the crash?
Yeah,
or?
I think it started to change before, and then the crash sort of, you know, put a dent in it. And then I think after was when it really started to go like that. I mean, I think, 2006, 2007 before the financial crisis was like, that's when it really became, when I think New York Tech, many of you have a perspective on this, like that's when New York Tech became what it is today. And that's when some of the most important companies were built. I still don't think we've built enough important companies, but that's my separate. But that's when a lot of the most important companies were built. That's when a lot of the venture firms were started. Mm-hmm. You know, that's when things like BetaWorks were getting going. I mean, that to me, that's when it really started.
Mm-hmm.
In the late 90s, it was like, it was a scene, it was a community, but it didn't have an identity like it does now.
Right. So when did you start thinking about like selling to Lycos, getting your next, you know, foot forward?
Yeah. Well, that came, you know, very organically. I mean, we weren't thinking about selling the company. I mean, I think, you know, the old saying, like, the best way to, or the worst way to sell something is to try to sell it.
Right.
So we got approached by them, and we weren't really thinking about it. And they, you know, they were so far ahead. I mean, Lycos at the time was you know, the Google of the day. I mean, it was really Lycos and Yahoo. They were battling it out, and they were interesting because they were profitable.
Right.
Which, by the way, to be a profitable internet company public in 1997 was just an incredible thing to do. And so that was when they approached us, is when we were like, wow, you know, we should. And, you know, I'm very happy we did it, but it was Dick Sabat who was like, look, I mean, these guys are offering this, and we got pretty much nothing here. so we should probably do it.
You put pretty and, much but, nothing but meaning no
that,
revenue
that was
and,
the thing, right?
Yeah.
But there was no, back then there was, we didn't anyway. And I think this is probably, if we had been here,
right.
Versus there, it's like not that far, right? But if we had been here, I think we would have had a different perspective.
What perspective would you?
That having, being the eighth largest site on the internet was value in and of itself.
Right, right,
that
right.
You didn't need to have revenue.
Right.
But we were up in the, you know, up there, and I was, he's an economics professor, and he's like, wait a minute, so this and this? Like, no,
right,
no,
right,
we gotta sell.
Right. So, and he was the adult in the room.
And he was the adult in the room, and it was hard to argue. Right. Mm-hmm. And I think and you know, he was an incredible salesperson, and which amazing as an economics professor. But he would do these great calculations, like he would sit by that time Brett had left, and he would sit me down and he would say, you know, if we do this, 175 kids are gonna be put through college on the proceeds. I'm like, oh geez, Dick. Really? I mean, that's that, like,
right?
Because
right,
he
right.
had to convince me a little bit. I was, you know, what did I have to lose? I had nothing to lose.
Yeah, go ahead.
Cool. Question. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I'm just curious. You talked about why we haven't had enough big wins, and I'm curious your perspective on that. Like, we haven't had a Google, we haven't had a Facebook, a Twitter. I'm from the West.
By we, you mean New York?
I mean New York, because what you said earlier is also true. This is an amazing city.
I know.
For people who are doing something new, and yet we still haven't had a big West Coast style win.
I mean, I would challenge you to name one. It's also not what the Valley has that we don't have is places where executives can hide, right? So if you are gonna take a risk on a startup and it doesn't work out, you need to be able to know if you've got a family that you can go get a job at eBay, Google, Apple, you name it, right? I mean, there's literally 50 companies, 50 native digital public companies within a 25-minute drive that when your startup goes south, you can sort of tuck in for a couple years and come out. And it's not so much for the entrepreneurs as it is for the executives, right, who bounce in and out of these startups to run sales or run marketing or run. Here, I mean, there's no place to go. You know, I mean, we don't have, IAC is the closest thing we have to a native, digital, public, like real company.
So you think it's a lack of companies trying? It's a lack of entrepreneurs going for it?
I don't have a great answer. I mean, I'd be interested. I don't know why we haven't been able to build that core company that really is the center of the ecosystem. I think what's happening is we're adopting Google and Facebook offices because New York is 1,000 times cooler than San Francisco. So, which is, it is, right? It's so true. And so they all know that. And they know that they have a chance to be those companies here because we don't have them ourselves. And they're buying up city blocks. you know, to, and I, it's great. And I think we're going to have to probably, we're going to have those as our, and I think that will help tremendously, because then there will be places for people to go, you know, grab jobs. If we had an Amazon office, that would help a lot. But I don't know. I always say, I think part of it is the fault of the venture capitalists. Like I spend time at Greycroft and I think we do a great job. And, you know, I think BetaWorks does a great job and we don't think about it the way that those guys think about it out there. I mean, they're doing it at such a higher level. You know, we are still transacting every single deal. Whereas out there, they're just, the way they do the business and the vision that they have, I think, is just greater than what we have here. But I think in part because they have pattern recognition.
Yeah.
They've seen these companies be built right in front of them, and they've been part of it, and they're playing with the house's money. So it's like, let's do it. You know, 50 million Series A, great. Guy who's built two companies, you know, can only lose one times your money. Like, that's the way that they think about it. We just haven't gotten there yet. The closest thing we have is what Fred does at Union Square, and he doesn't even really do that anymore the way he used to.
I guess my question is, what do you think would have happened to Tripod had you not sold it?
I think it would have been a mess. To be honest. I think it would have been a mess.
Like what? What? You've thought about this. You've gamed this out.
So there were three companies. There was GeoCities, there was Tripod, and there was The Globe. And The Globe went out of business, the founders made, and everybody made no money. Mm-hmm. Some people who were tiny shareholders got out at the IPO because it went way up. But if you were locked, you were in. So, and then it literally went to zero. So, would we have been GeoCities or a version of it, or would we have been a version of The Globe? I think the odds are we would have been a version of The Globe, because we were never going to be able to. We built the business to 100 people in Williamstown. We were never going to be able to build it to 1,000 people. Like, that just isn't, we just couldn't.
What's your answer about getting one on the board?
Yeah, and that was, and I think we got one on the board, and I think that was, it was great. And I there was so much risk, I think, for what we were doing. Like, we would have had to raise so much more capital to be able to get to where GeoCities got, and we always would have been a second player. And the rule, even today, and even more so today, is that the multiple afforded to the winner of the category is just so outsized relative to second and third.
What did GeoCities really end up to be? It didn't really end up that much.
Oh, no, it was, they went public and Yahoo bought them for $3 billion. It was a good outcome.
Yeah,
but
it ended up
where? Oh, well, they've all ended up in the dust pile. I mean, all Lycos, everybody. I mean, all of the internet, I mean, I don't know. Yahoo is the closest, maybe the only thing that is still left from that. AltaVista, Lycos, Excite, all gone.
But how do you deal with that emotionally? I just find that to be so insane. I mean, I'm a journalist, as you know, and you know we're dealing with like this rapid shift in our industry. So I, for kind of the first time, I'm like, oh my God, am I old? What is happening?
Yeah.
Do I not know how to do that thing? Like, I mean, how do you, you're still sitting here, you're still an entrepreneur, but how do you deal with the rapid shift? And I mean, for people in this room who are, I'm sure at all different like levels and of their careers, I mean, it just must be psychologically taxing to feel like you're surfing a wave that's always going to crash on top of you.
It is. It's funny. I someone asked me today, this company that I'm involved with, said, are you on Slack? And I was like, no, I'm not on Slack. I'm not on your Slack channel. And they were like, well, you know, why not? And I'm like, well, because I'm betting that in 6 months there'll be something else other than Slack, and I'll have to know. But that's sort of
right.
The joke, right? Is that it's this constant churning of innovation. But that's what's cool about it too.
Right.
It's like, you know, I mean, but it is like art, you know, it churns. Like mm-hmm. Music doesn't stay, you know, and then there's some music that does stay relevant forever.
Right, right,
there are
right.
some companies that I think are going to be relevant for a lot longer than others.
Yeah.
Just like there have been in other portions of the technology business. I mean,
right.
Microsoft has been around since the 70s.
Yeah, but in the story that I wrote about Silicon Alley 1.0, you know, the central like theme is basically like, this is punk rock. If you were here like in the mid 90s, that is punk rock. And now like little bits of it are getting like eaten. And now it's like, whoosh, you know. I mean, it just takes a certain kind of optimism
if we had a group of, there's certain things, I think, and I think if we had a group of, you know, like VR entrepreneurs here, they would tell you that their ecosystem is more like that, you know, where it's just like people are trying anything and, you know, and some of the stuff that these guys do with camps, you know, they're taking those things that are really nascent and that are, people are like, oh, I'm not sure, you know, people are sort of on the one hand celebrating, on the other hand, like, is that really going to work? So I still think that that happens, you know, but the sort of the snake has to keep molting its skin in order for this whole thing to work.
In the book, you say, you know, the entrepreneur has one job, which is to create a market for his or her stock. Do you still believe that to be the case?
Yes. Your first, second, and third job as an entrepreneur is to this is what I was saying. You have to make sure the company has capital.
And I mean, you talk a lot about the press and how like the press was on your side because you were like the bro in Williamstown who was having fun at the same time surfing the internet wave, blah, blah, blah. Like what, I mean, is the press still as relevant or what do you think is taken place? I mean, is it likes? Is it this? Is it that?
I don't think the press is as relevant. The press as we remember it, you know, I don't think is as relevant. In fact, I think PR as a strategy for marketing your company is not, it's not really a thing anymore. You know, you have these growth hackers who know how to seed things in the right places and in, you know, on the internet. It's not about that classic, like, oh, we're going to create a story and it's this. I mean, you do a press release, but it's nowhere near. When we got a story, I remember we got a story in People magazine. It was just like, the next day, it was like everything changed. You know, it was just like people were calling us, advertisers calling us. Like,
right.
It's not like that anymore.
Yeah. You need to have that. But if you had it times 10, you might
none of that. I don't think any of it works. You know, the only thing that I think is like a game changer for companies that makes an overnight is some sort of distribution relationship with another company that sort of can create that step change. Like the press doesn't do it anymore.
So what like is your, I mean, you say basically like I was lucky enough to know, I was smart enough to know when I was getting lucky, right? In terms of not only selling to Lycos, but then selling the Lycos stock before the crash. Do you believe that about the crash as well? That you, I mean, did you have a sense like there is going to be a crash and
Not really. I mean, I think that was a time when Dick's influence was, you know, sort of positive again, was that he was like, this is all pretty crazy. And we should, you know, think about. But I don't think anyone really saw that coming. Just like nobody saw the real estate crisis. I mean, some people did and they made movies about them, you know. Like, it was very few people.
Yeah.
We were talking like, I don't know why no one's made a movie about the .com.
I know. We had a great idea for a movie back there. Then like 1997, New York City.
It's gotta be. It's gotta
Silicon
be.
Alley.
It's gotta
I'm writing
There's
a treatment when
books.
I get home.
There's some great books.
I think it was too quick.
Yeah.
It was like a flash.
Yep.
Survivors are so few. It's a survivor. So any questions from the audience? Yes?
No, I just would like to hear how being a venture capitalist has impacted how you are now an entrepreneur. How do you balance the two of those and how do they impact each other?
It's funny, people say that the common wisdom on this is that the best venture capitalists were entrepreneurs because they can understand what the entrepreneur is going through and they can, you know, help. But I've sort of come to believe that the opposite is also true, that if you've spent time on the venture side of the business, you become a much better entrepreneur because the number of successes and mistakes you see on a weekly basis is like your pattern recognition gets so much better. When you're in your startup, you're in it and you can't pull yourself out and look at, and you don't have the opportunity, you don't have the information, you're not exposed to, you know, 100 different ideas and deals a week, which is what, you know, at Greycroft, it's 4,000 a year. So, you know, every Monday it's just like a fire hose. We're just seeing all the stuff and you see what's working and what isn't working. And I just learned so much from that. Now, I don't know how we could actually make that happen
right.
for everyone.
Yeah.
We have, Graycraft has sort of an open door policy to let people come and hang out at partner meetings. And sometimes we get, you know, some entrepreneurs that come in and you know, see the, try to get the pattern recognition, but it's helped so much, so much.
Do you think you're coming out of college right now with your skill set, so you're 22, do you think you'd still be as wildly successful as you were but back then? Do you think you could do it now with the competition and the capital and everything that's out there now?
I'm trying to do it now.
No, but you're not 22.
It's oh, when I was 22.
You knew nothing, right?
It's a great, no, I mean, the kids are doing it.
Yeah.
So could I do it? Yeah. You know, yeah, I think so. I mean, I'd like to think so. You know,
what is it about you that you think would propel you?
I think, you know, it's just about resilience. I mean, that's really, you just have to never get discouraged when somebody tells you no, right? I mean, that's like the old saying about sales. You know, no is the beginning of the conversation, and that's really what it comes down to. If you can get up every day and have people throw you out of offices and slam doors in your face and say no, and you just get back up and you keep doing it, and you don't view it as an affront, right, and you don't take it personally, and you just sort of keep going. That's what it takes, and I think that it's not different today than it was back then.
But the culture is so much more ego-stroking today, though. It's so hard to like get, you know, to have all these people loving you and then like people rejecting you. You know what I mean? Like the whole social mediaization of it, I think.
I think the thing that would work, the thing that worries me today is the false positives that you get. Actually, there's so much money and so much venture capitalists out there that and there's these teams of associates who just have nothing to do but take meetings, and so they just take meetings with everybody, and they don't want to discourage you. So you go into these rooms and you meet with these associates, and they're like, oh yeah, it sounds great, you know, and they're just trying to get as much information as they possibly can, and it makes you as
to do what, put it in a spreadsheet so that people know what everybody's working on, and like, okay,
absolutely. And you know, data hasn't really hit this asset class, and it's really for the first time. Like, if you look at PitchBook and Crunchbase, like, those are the first times that we've had anything close to what Wall Street and other asset classes have had for so long. That you can actually look up companies, see how much they've raised, see from who, have they been successful, you know. So anyway, these associates are collecting that data, and the entrepreneur walks out and feels like it was a good meeting, and it was basically nothing. It was, so, and being able to discern that is, you can just waste so much time. You know, I have entrepreneurs who I mentor who, like, you know, who they come and they're like, oh, I got a call from somebody at Summit. I'm like, yeah, they have a call program. They have 20 kids who just call companies and try to get as much information. And it's really cool to get a call from Summit or from TA or from one of these places that has these call programs. But you have to know that. So I think that would be the hard thing, is to piece your way through. Back then, it was like they threw you out of the office, or they didn't. Like, they, what? And if they didn't, then they were really interested, right? It wasn't a lot of, there wasn't a lot of false
grace.
Positives. Yeah, there wasn't.
Go ahead.
I was curious, do you see, compared to Silicon Valley or anywhere else, do you see a certain type of company, a certain industry of startups that is uniquely better or good in New York City? It seems like, from riding the subway, I see a lot of mattresses and toothbrushes. I don't know if that's the hotbed.
Just how
of
many
York.
Can you sleep on?
Yeah.
I don't know if is
you
that where
give
the
them
best,
back.
The best young companies days. Are. Or what do you see?
I do. I think the D2C commerce, you know, the direct to consumer commerce stuff, is definitely. I mean, this has always been a good place for that because there's a lot of talent around consumer facing e-commerce and media. You know, I think in some ways, though, those companies are a sign of what holds us back, right? Because it's like, let's just take pillows and sell them online, right? Like, who cares? Like, that isn't, you know, that isn't an innovation, really. That could, it's going to be I'm sure Brooklyn will be a nice company, but it's not fully radically changing an entire industry. Like people are, you know, I don't know if you're a crypto believer or not a crypto believer, but I can tell you that what's interesting to me about crypto is that the last thing that the Valley hasn't disrupted is the currency system. And I can tell you, like, they're gonna disrupt it. One way or another, they will, because the people out there look at what's happening on Wall Street and they're like, that sucks. That's in our way. That whole, the way that the banks work and the gives and the takes and like,
yeah,
we don't want that. So they are gonna figure out a way to disrupt that. And whether it's through crypto or through some other iteration of that, and that's the way they think. It's like, let's just take an entire industry like transportation and disrupt it, just break it right down. Whereas we're trying to sell stuff online. You know? It's sad. But we need to think different. We need to think about disrupting entire, like, what is, you know, we don't think that way. Not enough, at least. And I'm at fault.
No, I think that's true. And I think that when you hear just, like, conversation between, among anybody in the Valley, it's just like that's what they're talking about all the time. And here we don't have those kinds of expansive dinner conversations. People are too afraid of looking dumb.
On the like the tail end of just like marketing pillows online, do you think it's like an in-house creative marketing?
Don't tell me you market pillows.
Jesus, no. I'm just saying, like, do you feel like it's because those teams might have like more in-house thought leaders versus like New York, that we are like the epicenter of advertising? Like, do you think advertising here is like, you know, like a stick in the mud? And that's the reason why.
I do. I think that we have industries here that are going to hold us back a little bit because they're just not. So we're taking industries here that we've had and we're just trying to sort of put them on the internet, right? Like in the Valley, they just don't even think that way. They're like, what they think about industries to disrupt. And so that's not, like, if you were thinking that way, you would never sell pillows online, right? Because that's not an industry, it's like, that's, you know, you're just taking something and you're selling it another way versus the way it used to be sold. So I do think that the industries here that have formed the backbone of the city hold us back. Tech is not the backbone of the city. I think more and more, it is, and I think there's a lot of people and a lot of people in this room who want it to be more that way. In fact, one of the reasons why it's 1,000 times cooler to live here is because tech's not the backbone of the city. And so that's the sort of give and take, right, is that Silicon Valley is the, I mean, I can't believe people live there. It's, you know, it's terrible. I mean, you know, versus New York, right? I mean, it's just strip malls and there's very little culture, and San Francisco's getting better as a city and more people are moving down there. But
they have Burning Man.
You know,
they got 1 week a year.
But New York is cool because we're not defined by really any one industry. I mean, I guess finance to some extent, but I think it also holds us back because we're not, you know, so steep. That's why we don't make the as good of movies as Los Angeles. We were not like so focused on one thing, and I think that they are. And they're mm-hmm. it's all about disruption. Yep. We have a lot of things that are percolating and starting from scratch in a real way, and I think that's always been an interesting part of the New York ecosystem. I just want more to go to 100, you know, because I think long term, if we really want to be and we are at this point, you know, we're a bigger tech ecosystem than Boston, and if we want to hold that position and have a chance at being number one and not letting Seattle or LA or, you know, take over, I think we need to build bigger companies.
But isn't that what's going to happen on the waterfront? Like, assuming that global warming isn't going to like swamp the entire city and particularly my neighborhood. That's what's going to happen. I mean, that's what everybody thinks happen. It's like in 20 years or something. Okay, yeah, go ahead.
So you mentioned before that there's basically any night of the week in New York City you can go and kind of meet funders and get your idea heard. But I think particularly for women and women of color in particular, it's not a secret that it's hard for us to get access to capital. And just because there are a load of events that you could meet people doesn't mean that you're going to get funded. But what if you truly do have one of those ideas that you're really trying to pound the pavement? What recommendations would you give for particularly a female founder of color to actually go beat down some doors? But then also the question is, what stage do you need to be at before you start pounding those doors? Do you need to have proof of concept? Do you actually need to have a demo of your product already done? Or do you think that it depends, depending upon the funder?
Yeah. It definitely depends on the funder. And by the way, I was at a board meeting on Thursday and I looked around the room and it was like, it was all white males. And I made the comment, that we need to change this. Like, it is hard. And I don't mean to be glib when I say it's easy to get funded these days. It's just, it does depend on the backer, on where you need to be. I mean, I think that there's some people in this city doing some great work. Female Founders Fund is one that I know well. They are working to break down that barrier and to give people coaching on how to get into those rooms and shake the money loose. Because that's the thing, getting in the room, anyone can get in the room, right? It's how do you talk to the investor in that type of a setting in a way that will get you to that meeting, right? Because it's generally a very quick interaction and understanding how to what to say. Is an important thing, and I think they're doing some great work on coaching people who are at it for the first time to do that. But there's no magic bullet. I mean, I think we have a long way to go on sort of democratizing access to capital, and there's a lot of good people working on it. And I know we've gone to great lengths, at Greycroft to diversify the staff there, and I think that helps, right? When you go into a room and you see people that look like you, it helps. Right, to just make you feel more comfortable, and I think that's a big part of pitching your business the right way, but a long way to go.
Could you give an example of, like, we just walked into a room, hi, and we want to pitch you. Like, what would work in a room full of white guys? Because usually if I would walk in a room, most people would first say that I'm in marketing, which that is true most of the time. I'm actually just in biz dev. But what would work? Like, what works in that setting? If you're most of the time, in the meantime, before it gets all, like, a lot of women in a room and there's a lot of, like, different, like, before you go hiring people for the status quo.
So I'll say this, that I see a lot of pitch decks. So let's take it out of the room where you have the two-minute interaction. But I see a lot of pitch decks where the entrepreneurs almost always, no matter who they are, start with 10 slides on the product, and then they talk about the revenue model and what traction they have. And I always say, flip that. And the first slides or the first thing out of your mouth should be about the business model that, the opportunity you see to create a business in a market, right? In a product in a market. And how the economics of that. And if you have traction and you have revenue, to put that right up front and say, hey, I'm growing my business. I had $25,000 a month of revenue last month, and this month I'll do 40, and then it looks like the next month I'll do 70, and then I'm telling you that's all it takes. And they will be listening to you intently and asking you for your card. And now, if you're not at that point, then you need to figure out what's the right version of that. The thing that gets them to respond that way that you can offer, right? I know something about a market. I have a perspective that no one has. And this part of the market is, inefficient, and here's why, and I've got a product. Something that appeals to, because it's the pitch of, hey, I've got this great idea because, I don't like my toothbrush. Like, that don't do that. A lot of people do. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's amazing, right? A lot of people take that approach, and that's not, the approach is not, I have a personal problem I'm trying to solve. It's I have a unique perspective on a market.
But I think also just in terms of your language, like I talk to a lot of my friends who have businesses, and we try to just make the language as you know, kind of conversational as possible, and use some humor, and just try to not be like, you know, 16 syllables a word coming at you, because it's really hard for people who are leaders and entrepreneurs to really think about, you know, vocabulary in that way.
Just a quick question following up. Is it a good idea to cold email VCs?
No.
And then, okay, that's easy.
Why not? Just because they will delete it?
Or it. Yeah. Not, you know, you need to get introduced by someone. And just and if you can't get introduced to them, find another firm where you can. But yeah, cold emails don't work.
Okay, and then as far as like looking through decks, what percentage of the slides on average do you go through? Just curious.
Well, when it's a 10-page deck, I go through every one. When it's a 30-page deck, I don't. And I tell entrepreneurs, you know, you should never have more than 10 slides. It just, if you can't tell it in 10 slides, you know. Now, you can have 10 slides in a 10-slide appendix, and that's great. So if I'm interested after the 10 slides and I want to go deeper on any given topic, great. But if it's a 10-slide deck and it's well-designed, I read every one.
Hey, what's your favorite question to ask companies that are pitching you that's somewhat unique to yourself? You know, it's like your secret question.
I mean, you know, because I come at it from the perspective of an entrepreneur, I oftentimes will ask, you know, if you weren't doing this, what else would you be doing? To try to get a sense for, you know, is this like the calling, you know, or are there five other ideas that, you know, they've gotten their bag, and if I don't like this one, you know, here's another one. So I'll often that. And the answers, you know, vary, obviously, but I always get something interesting out of that question.
But the right answer is, this is the only thing I want to do.
Well, that's too right.
Yeah.
Right answer is a little bit more nuanced. But yes, it's a version of that.
All right, guys, that's all we have for you today. We'd like to say thank you so much to Beau for being our beta in this new AMA series. You'll hear more great guests from our community very, very soon. Beau also has a book, Lucky or Smart, and it's out now. If you're a member of Studios and had come to the live talk, you would have got a free book. So for more membership perks, check out betaworks-studios.com, where you'll also find out what exciting sessions we have coming up and how to join our community. For more episodes of Builders, subscribe in iTunes or wherever else you listen to podcasts. If you'd like to leave us a review, that would also be so amazing. It helps more people like you find all of this great advice from people like Beau. Check back with us every Tuesday for new episodes. Follow along with us on social media. You can be found on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook at BuildersPod, #BuildersPodcast for all things Builders. If you click on the description box, it's all linked there. If you'd like a day pass to come hang out at BetaWorks Studios, just let me know. I can be found on Twitter at Layla Ueda. But also, just feel free to click on the description box for my info and all the ways to reach me. We look forward to hearing from you and seeing you. Until next time, I'm Layla Ueda. Happy building from all of us at the BetaWorks Studios team.